Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to the Money Show. It is Wednesday night. Oh, my goodness gracious me. I beg your pardon. How rude. It is Wednesday night. I'm Bruce Whitfield, and I do introduce you to my frog, whose name is Kermit. We're going to be doing a special outside broadcast this evening. It's outside but inside, just across our entertainment area here at 702 in Johannesburg. Is a massive setup. People are arriving, having nice drinks and having some nice snacks. And we're going to be talking this evening about the Youth Employment Service and the scourge of unemployment, particularly amongst young people who are let down by a schooling system that fails them generally, by a university system that can't cope with an influx of young people, many of whom drop out in year one, who then come into the jobs market to find there are no jobs. And so the Yes campaign, tasked by President Cyril Ramaphosa more than 2 years ago now to create a million jobs within 3 years, they're nowhere near that. They were never going to get anywhere near that, but it lit a fire that has led to some quite remarkable progress being made and getting corporate South Africa involved. And what we do want tonight is for you to participate. We are going to be taking calls this evening. We will have various corporate representatives on stage as well. We'll hear from some of the young people who've benefited from the Yes campaign. We'll learn all about that tonight here on The Money Show. We'll talk about the currency, better than 15 to the dollar this evening. It's had a very good day, nearly 2% stronger, also better off against the pound, touching 18 to the pound today. We'll also talk about WEF Africa, World Economic Forum Africa, and Adrian Gore, the chief executive of Discovery, standing by. We'll talk to him in just a moment. Just a thought for Bruce Corwane, the ambassador to the Netherlands. He's resigned. He's been recalled after his state capture testimony in the Gupta's Waterkloof landing. Actually, we should be grateful to Bruce Corwane. We really should. Because, I mean, the country was on a slippery slope. We were headed towards the abyss. And Bruce Corwane's decision to allow the Guptas to land at Waterkloof was one of those things that highlighted the Gupta grip on the presidency at the time. And Barry Bateman, of course, broke that story, and the huge wedding at Sun City and all of the stories that followed after that. But had Bruce Corwane not allowed that landing, the damage could have continued for much longer. So a little bit of gratitude, cynically, I think, to Bruce Corwane tonight.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7 and 106 FM.
Well, Discovery did warn last week that its profits would come under pressure as it invested heavily in new businesses, particularly its bank and in the UK as well. Discovery's got a broad spread of financial services businesses nowadays. Of course, it is involved not only in health insurance, but in life insurance, short-term insurance, banking now, and also indirectly in asset management too. Confirmation today that full-year profit was down 12%. And Adrian Gore, the Discovery Holdings founder and chief executive, the core health business, despite the fact that you only grew members by about 1% this year, Adrian Gore, the health business actually did perform quite nicely.
Bruce, the business, I think the health business is extremely robust. So the new business grew by 1%. So it's still a large slice of new business, but the business is very, very robust. It's of scale and it continues to perform very, very well.
I mean, the profits, though, in the health, and this is always contentious and it always needs to be explained, profits in the health business up 10%, new members up just 1%. Please explain that.
Well, you've got kind of a natural process of inflation driving up profitability, efficiency driving up profitability. So if you work it out mathematically, those identities tend to just work out. Bear in mind that our fees grow at inflation, so it's a very, very regulated structure. But we're working very hard on technology and efficiency and on service. So it's a constant process.
When you talk about that, I mean, bringing the efficiencies into the system, so basically cutting the costs of delivering the insurance service to your customers then is what boosts the profitability.
No, I mean, growth boosts profitability. So the membership grows and that's obviously important. But you know, we're investing in a lot of things that make it easier to interact with us. It's not necessarily cutting costs per se, but healthcare is a hugely technology-based business where you've got complex claims processes and complex omni-channel communication issues. So there's real opportunity to add value to customers and at the same time be more efficient. There's no trade-off.
You've got a surplus of 816 million rand sitting in the medical scheme. How does that compare to previous years? Is it a substantial slug of cash?
You know, the surplus inside the medical scheme, which is a separate entity, you know, we're the administrator of it, is about 17 or 18 billion. So the solvency requirements of the Medical Schemes Act requires the medical scheme to hold considerable amounts of cash. So we, you know, we price it very, very tightly in terms of not creating unnecessary surplus that isn't necessarily needed, but making sure we cover the claims cost. So I don't think it's dramatically different to previous periods. There were things in the last year like the VAT increase that cost the medical scheme that wasn't planned, but generally I think the performance is very good. I mean, I think the delivery to our customers is very good. And most importantly, we're trying to keep costs down for members. I mean, that's our social mandate.
Yeah, I mean, being upbeat in recent days, I mean, we've seen lots of quotes from you and from your colleagues within Discovery talking about NHI. We touched on this briefly the other day, being about the opportunities that NHI might bring. But there's a huge amount of fear. I mean, your customer base must be absolutely petrified of the possibility that if they are allowed access to a medical aid at some point in the future, not only are they going to have to cop up for medical aid payments in the future, but they're also going to have to subsidize NHI, whether or not they use public services into the future. You talk about this is a great opportunity. Just how robust are the discussions around NHI right now?
You know, I hope we don't sound flippant. I don't think we mean opportunity. I think we've tried to be clear that directionally we're supportive of what government is trying to do in terms of the status quo not being really sustainable. But at the same time, we've tried to put across clearly that the role of the private sector and of medical schemes is fundamental as a safety valve. Forget about our business interests, but in fact, is required. And so we've tried to put across the important need for a private system that works with and around the NHI. And therefore, we've been trying to be clear that we don't see anything in our planning horizon that's dramatically different, certainly over the next while. So it's not a flippant statement. It's more an issue that we want to make sure we are constructive partners in helping build where we can, but we strongly believe in what we're doing, and I think that's important.
I mean, is that discussion happening with the Department of Health, or is it an internal discussion that you're broadcasting to a concerned public?
You know, if you read the NHI bill, I mean, it talks about the complementary role of medical schemes. That at the moment is a very vague statement, and it's going to have to be developed and debated over the next, you know, 5, 7, 10 years. I think that debate is just starting. So it's not a matter of internal or external. I think that there's going to be many parties debating that. I think that an astute observer would, if you do the numbers and you understand the levels of inequality and the levels of lack of resources, we just don't have enough money as a country to fund one system that covers everything. So I think just the kind of logic dictates where I think it will go, but we have to build something that's sustainable. So we are, I think, optimistic about adding value and trying our best to make sure that kind of unnecessary negative sentiment doesn't pervade.
Your life insurance company, there was a spike in claims in the first 6 months of this year. Have things calmed down? I don't know what caused the death of an increased number of your clients. I mean, is there a general trend at play in South Africa? Is it stress-related? Is it heart attack-related? Is it cancer-related? I mean, it's a very stressful society in which we live on a daily basis.
You know, in difficult times, you do see an escalation in claims, particularly disability claims or income protection claims. What happened to us actually in the first 6 months was kind of a random bunch of a small number of very large claims. It's more statistical, and kind of I think we needed slightly different reinsurance structures to smooth out the volatility. We did that and restructured things in the second half. It was actually back down to where we expected. So nothing dramatic in that. I think just simply an issue of random fluctuation. That does happen from time to time, but it does have an impact on the numbers, but I think the second half kind of reverted back to normal, and we're pretty comfortable going forward.
Discovery Bank, 22,000 clients. I mean, did you expect to be further ahead by now?
No. You know, I think we were late getting out there. It's taken us a long time. We should have been out there in April. It took us till July. We kind of said we'd like to get to 1,000 clients a day during September, which is what we did. Bear in mind, Bruce, this is a pretty heavy bank, so people are coming in, they're borrowing, they're depositing. To put on 1,000 clients a day with all the necessary, they call the call centers and ascertain how all the different products work. So I think it's pretty good going if we can keep that going. 22,000 clients, 50,000 accounts. The deposit rate is excellent. I think we're over 200 million, nearly a billion in lending approved. So it's literally 6 weeks into the proper rollout. I think we're feeling pretty good about it.
I mean, you've got, 200 million rand in deposits. That's roughly 9,000 rand a customer. It does suggest that fewer than that number are treating you as their primary banking relationship. It feels like this is a test phase for many people.
I think we'll probably see that for a few months. I think the value proposition is, I think, is so powerful that that's really the strategy. Let people use the bank, let them test it. I think they'll see as they use it, the value is tremendous. So we're not unhappy with that.
Have you closed all your other bank accounts? Or is all your banking with Discovery Bank?
Mine, in the process, is I've used the bank almost exclusively for all the stuff I do day to day. I get a massive thrill out of using the bank. I find it very, very appealing.
Does it work?
Oh, it does work. Give it a try.
The new business at Discovery Insure is flat, and that's really quite interesting because, I mean, you guys advertise extensively. It's a highly competitive market, and it is possibly the clearest indication in these results that the real economy is hurting. I mean, we see it happening on our streets on a daily basis now. We're seeing lots of angry people on the streets. But also in your demographic, with people you're trying to appeal to, insurance is a grudge purchase at many points. And maybe that's where it's being felt most across the Discovery business?
You know, it's interesting. It's a point I tried to make this morning, but I don't think I made it well enough. If you look across our business, I mean, one of the greatest tests of economic times, of difficulty of clients, this is not to say there isn't difficult times, but of how our model is working is the lapse rate. In other words, people leaving us. And in fact, across the board, from insure to invest to health to life, the lapse rate, people leaving us, is lower than ever. The lapse rates are very tight. So ironically, the business is remarkably sticky. The new business in Discovery Insure was more of a process of us switching off a number of brokers. We felt were not giving us the quality we expected. So it was an explicit strategy of ours. We're pretty comfortable we'll grow strongly this year. I think Insure has been about real quality, higher than average premiums, and I think we're doing very well. So more a kind of an explicit act. But again, I think you're right. These are very tough times, but our business has proved to be remarkably resilient.
Those lapse rates, the fact that they're sitting at record lows, I mean, do you attribute that to the Vitality interface across all of these products? I mean, if you properly engage with Vitality and you go across multiple product streams with Vitality and you can figure it out, the rewards programs that the few people who do spend time with this stuff aspire to do kick in quite heavily.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, I think the dynamic across virtually every business, whatever it is quite the same. People tend to engage, and then they tend to stay if they engage. The people that don't engage tend to lapse. So you, over time, probabilistically, the people with you are sticky and are engaging. You know, that's exactly the kind of selective lapsation process you want. So absolutely correct.
Adrian Gore, Chief Executive at Discovery, the founder of Chief Executive. Are you a sticky Discovery customer? Should have a wash. Yes, Adrian Gore, Discovery Chief Executive. We'll get analysis on those results with Chris Stewart, Portfolio Manager at Investec Asset Management. He is standing by about that. MMI came out with some numbers today. The Rand has been nothing short of extraordinary on the day. The emerging markets currency basket has been really strong. But yeah, nearly 2% better against the dollar tonight. The pound is weak as well. And Boris Johnson facing all kinds of pressures within his parliament, and the Eurozone also under pressure too. So that is part of tonight's discussion with Chris Stewart in a few minutes.
The Money Show. The Markets.
Chris Stewart, Portfolio Manager at Investec Asset Management. What do you make of Discovery?
Discovery.
Company insurance, does health, does life cover, got a bank. You've heard of them?
Always a fantastic presentation, and Adrian Gore again gave a very accomplished presentation from the podium today, all 1.5 hours of Discovery. The business is obviously in a tougher space than it has been for some time. I think they're unaccustomed to stand up on the podium and talk about earnings that have gone backwards. Nonetheless, I think a mix of positives and negatives coming out of their numbers today. The banking operation, the live display of some of the tech within the banking operation as a banks analyst, I found quite impressive. It was good to see Adrian on his mobile phone on a big screen transferring loyalty points from one account to the other live. So, you know, certainly some good technology banking backing up their banking offering. Time will tell just how much impact that particular product can make. The health business, which really has been the backbone and the core cash cow of that business over many, many years, market having some concerns over the impact of the NHI bill long term on Discovery Health's future. And whilst there were some comments around that today, still huge lack of clarity, I guess, as to the impact that might have on that business. And remember, that really has been the core cash generator for the business, with many of the other businesses still in growth phase, sucking up cash. The life business in South Africa, which has been another business that generates very, very, very polarized views in the market as to whether that's a great investment or a terrible investment, given the fact that it doesn't generate cash particularly, and the more successful it is, the less cash it generates, because, as you know, you sell a life policy that's got a very, very long-ended cash flow stream, but the cost of putting that asset on your book up front, paying brokers commissions to sell it, etc., is very, very cash consumptive. That business now, you know, having their first real wobble from a performance point of view for quite some time. They had a mortality problem in the first half of the year, looking a little bit better in the second half of the year. They've taken some remedial action, but still concerns over the mortality losses within that business and the extent to which those can become more than a one-off trend.
I mean, we look at the big discovery business, and they're spending an awful lot on building this bank. And as a bank's analyst, you look keenly at all of the micro detail in here. I mean, you know as well as I do that you don't make too much money from taking deposits. You make lots of money from lending money to those people who pay you interest on those loans. And you've got to have multiple products in that space. And Discovery just doesn't have the product suite that yet is convincing many of its competitors that it is a huge threat in the banking market. Are they complacent? Are they going to have a wake-up call, or are they right?
Well, you know, time will tell for sure. I mean, you can make money raising deposits. It obviously depends what rate of interest you pay on the deposits. A number of the big banks out there have got deposit books of multiple hundreds of billions of rands upon which they pay very little interest. You can reinvest that at the risk-free rate and still make a fairly handsome spread. That said, there's quite a lot of cost involved in raising those deposits as well, running branch infrastructure, core banking systems, etc. Ultimately, Discovery will need to have lending products probably that go over and above and beyond their existing credit card offering. But, you know, it's very early days for this business. It looks as though they've got a good transactional banking platform. If they can bring on transactional banking clients, if they can raise a reasonable amount of retail liabilities, and they can complement that in the fullness of time with a lending product, and they can continue to reward people for the appropriate types of behavior, keeping your savings in your account for longer, paying your debt, or at least if you've got multiple providers of debt, not defaulting at Discovery, but defaulting elsewhere. It may well be that this can be a credible offering and a decent money spinner for them into the future, but it's going to take some amount of time, I would imagine.
Yeah, and they're going to have to suck it up for some time as well. Taking a look at MMI, or what's it called now? Momentum Metropolitan, the big insurance company. It's on the mend? It's certainly the PR would suggest that it is.
You know, not as big as it used to be, I guess, Momentum Metropolitan. They've had a torrid time of it the last few years. That said, share up about 4% today on the back of their full-year earnings to the end of June, which read probably a little bit better than they are. And in their defense, they did point out the fact that the base was pretty shot with a number of recalibrations, restructuring that they went through last year. So instead of recording 50 or 60% earnings growth, it's more like 20% earnings growth. And obviously, some of that is assisted by markets and that sort of thing. You know, if you look at the actual delivery in terms of embedded value, new business volumes and the like, summing of a mixed bag and on my read, slightly light of where the market might have been expecting. In addition to that, a very guarded outlook statement, but I think if I was running a business in this environment, my outlook statement would be pretty guarded too. Nonetheless, the market quite liking it. That might have something to do with the fact that the stock, you know, is on a 4% plus dividend yield. They've done some fairly significant buybacks this year. It's only on about 8 to 8.5 times earnings. So ostensibly quite cheap. And I guess if you're ostensibly quite cheap and you don't disappoint hugely and indicate that things are broadly on track to continue to turn the business around, then, you know, the market receives it reasonably well, Bruce.
And the currency having a stormer of a day. I mean, it really is quite remarkable to see just the emerging market basket of currencies rallying strongly. And despite all of the woes and ructions, and you would have heard the protests from your office in Cape Town today, the currency doing remarkably well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not to take away from all the protests taking place all the way across this country, which I think are an absolute tragedy for South Africa at exactly the wrong time. The hunt for yield amongst emerging market investors firmly back on the table today. All emerging currencies, you know, the whole basket doing well, as you indicate, but I think the rand amongst the strongest of the emerging market currencies today, rallying up to 2% against some of the major crosses, in spite of everything that's going on domestically. How long that lasts, I'm not quite sure. What is exactly driving it? Well, apart from a little bit of a less bad news, I guess, on the global front from a volatility perspective, but equally well, continued indications of slowdown globally, a reasonably robust GDP print from us domestically yesterday, a confluence of events, I guess, coming together to bring investors back into the currency for the day at least.
Yep, for the day at least. Chris Stewart, thank you, Portfolio Manager at Investec Asset Management.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
Today's World Economic Forum Day 1 was hardly the sort of World Economic Forum that Cyril Ramaphosa was wanting to be hosting as president of the host country. The big protests outside, of course, and huge concerns there, of course. Africa's elite gathering in Cape Town, thousands taking to the streets protesting rape and violence against women. And it's a necessary protest because nothing has changed. In fact, things have got worse for women in South Africa. And it's not the image that we want to present to the world. I've got Hamburger Dave in Stockholm. He's a regular correspondent via social media, sending me a message this evening to say South Africa's even making it to the news in Stockholm. And Sweden doesn't care about what happens here, unless it's really big and significant. And they're seeing the deterioration of the fabric of South Africa as massively significant, and they should. On your next Money Show, we'll be coming to you from West Africa with our special broadcast, talking to Sibo Pichana, co-chair of the 28th World Economic Forum for Africa, Kenny Fietlau, Standard Bank, and other guests too. Also the CEOs of Sanlam and First Rand, their takes on the company financial results, of course, and they've got operations across the rest of the continent. Are they taking strain as South Africa gets on the wrong side of Africa's temperament? Next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show this Wednesday evening, when 54 countries unite to discuss one future at the World Economic Forum on Africa in Cape Town. You know that Standard Bank and 702 and Cape Talk will be part of that conversation. You know that we'll always keep you in the know about what the discussions are, and that's why we're bringing you the latest highlights and insights from WEF Africa 2019, live with Arabile Gumede, who's on the ground as we speak. We'll get to him in just a moment. Standard Bank calls Africa home, combining a strong African presence with global capabilities. As your trusted strategic partner, let Standard Bank connect you to Africa's opportunities. Arabile Gumede was inside the CTICC today as thousands of people converged on the World Economic Forum Africa. Could you hear the activity outside, Arabile? What was the response inside?
Oh, no, certainly did hear that the activity outside, Bruce. One can certainly assure you that the delegates inside were peering through the window and were even told to actually move away from the window out of fear. Certainly the responses are of not just shock, but certainly out of fear and worry and concern, really, about what it is exactly South Africa may certainly be going through at present. The messages are, however, of some sense of unity, trying to encourage people to perhaps get together and find a message that may not be mixed, but really one that stands firm and creates a more unified sort of Africa, if you want to call it that as well. We saw the president of Zimbabwe, that's Emmerson Mnangagwa, as well, come through early this morning as well, interact with quite a few people before doing it.
Earth to Arabile. He was going so well, like a steam train. There he is. You're back. Your phone died mid thrust. But that's okay. I mean, Emmerson Mnangagwa was there. Other African leaders there. But I mean, please just clarify for me if anybody has stayed away in protest at South Africa's xenophobic attacks and those issues, because there've been mixed reports all day.
Yeah, they certainly have. What we're getting as the official word from WEF, having chatted to the head of strategic communication, that's Oliver Kahn, he certainly says that, yes, the likes of Rwanda and Malawi did say they're not attending, but this was confirmed by Saturday already. And it isn't necessarily directly linked or related to the protests and the, of course, the xenophobic attacks that are certainly happening in and around the country. The likes of DRC have had no communication at all with WEF, so they're just assuming that they're not coming because of that. So any linkages with those countries not attending WEF Africa 2019 isn't necessarily linked with xenophobic attacks as yet, because no word has come through from those countries in that regard. They've just said they're not attending. So it certainly may be mixed messages, but it doesn't seem like a clear message with regards to why they're not there is currently attainable.
How effective a conversation can we really have at WEF Africa 2019 about a shared future for 54 countries across our continent, one single future, if not everybody is there? I mean, it does seem to be at risk of becoming a bit of a damp squib, or not?
Well, look, the word has been that way for quite some time, though, Bruce, right? We've heard murmurs time and time again that it is just a talk shop. And I suppose this year it almost heightens that sentiment because of the issues that are currently going on in and around South Africa, which are obviously, as you would know, spreading across the African continent, with the likes of ShopRite, the likes of MTN also being affected. Even MultiChoice, unfortunately, suffering at the hands of the xenophobic attacks which are spreading across the country. So indeed, it does aim to dull the conversation. It aims to perhaps put a dampener on any kind of constructive conversation which may come out of WEF Africa 2019. It doesn't seem that a clear message will come out, with all the parties not necessarily there.
Has there been any constructive discussion that you were aware of? I mean, I know you're not allowed into every plenary and into every nook and cranny, but you certainly get a clear sense when you're there as to whether or not people are enthused and buzzing by the prospect of a discussion that could take this continent forward.
So the real discussion points have really been about around the Africa Free Trade Agreement, and I think a lot of that is based on the fact that the rest of the world is going through this trade scenario, of course, this trade spat, the biggest of which is obviously between China and the United States. So strengthening relations in that regard has certainly been quite a key focal point. But the problem with that, Bruce, is that right now it doesn't seem that anybody is too focused on that because of the inner protests that are happening within South Africa's borders particularly, which are affecting conversations. Unfortunately, the president's mind, Cyril Ramaphosa, will certainly be fixated on other things as opposed to trying to get the message across, whether it be across 4IR or whether it be on trade. So that conversation would certainly be stalled in my mind, and you can almost feel that the sense of wanting to get the ball rolling but unable to do so out of fear of being insensitive as well to what is going on.
Yeah, I mean, we got a continent which is home to hundreds of millions of people. We are seeing population growth. We're not seeing economies grow fast enough to support population growth on this continent. We're talking the radical transformation of African economies using technology, using artificial intelligence, at a time where there's big risk of hunger across many economies and people not being able to even get second or third industrial revolution jobs.
Indeed. So having spoken to the Minister of Communication, actually, Bruce, she made note that Stella Ndabeni Abrahams, she made note vehemently that South Africa in particular almost missed the third industrial revolution, if not caught up to it at a very late stage. And the fear is then that we may lag behind quite a lot when it comes to the fourth industrial revolution. So investing in this revolution will certainly be very key and very important. But how do you do so then when you have a starving population in and around and mostly across the entire continent as well? Sub-Saharan Africa, for one, is certainly facing quite a big...
Earth to Arabile. We'll get hold of Arabile again tomorrow. Phones letting us down this evening. I'm going to talk to one of the cell phone chief executives in the next hour. Shout at him, just because we can. But yes, so what we're doing in the next 20 minutes or so is getting CEOs of top South African companies to join us as we chat to Tashmia Ismail Saville, and she's going to be talking to us about, yes, the campaign, the things it has achieved so far in terms of creating jobs, the opportunities that are so desperately needed in South Africa right now. We're going to do all of that between 7 and 8 o'clock this evening, taking your calls. I would love to hear from you if you are a devotee, if you're a critic of the Yes campaign, if you think it could work better, if you've got some ideas as to how to make it work better, and provided they're constructive, don't be a twit, please do give us a call.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7 and 106 FM.
Well, Arash Abedian, the chief executive at Pan African Investment and Research Services, doesn't take to social media often, but when he does, what he says is certainly worth paying attention to. I'm going to quote you his tweet today saying, SA clearly needs a socio-economic moral reboot. Daily evidence of violence against women and children, attacks on fellow Africans, and unabated abuse of office by political and corporate leaders pose additional serious risk to economic revival. President Ramaphosa needs to show step change and soon. Iraj Abedian on the line to us from Joburg this evening, the chief executive of Pan-African Investment and Research. You leave nobody untouched there, Iraj. I mean, I think you've encapsulated exactly what is going wrong in society, and it's big and it's broad and nobody is without blame.
Exactly, Bruce. I mean, it's a question of my humble view is that we should stop blaming each other and we should literally, as a matter of urgency, as a national priority, bring these issues to some form of national event and look into the eye of the problem and not point at each other as if anybody is innocent in this game. Because if not, not only people are going to die, literally, physically, mostly women and children, then we're going to destroy the reputation of the country, and the constitutional democracy is at risk, and the economy can only go one way when the situation is left, figuratively speaking, Bruce, rudderless ship, as they say.
I mean, we should be putting on a far better show, World Economic Forum Africa. We should have a lot more positive things to talk about. We're a critical economy on this continent, and we want to talk about a continent of 54 countries and one vision, and we can't even agree amongst ourselves in South Africa what our vision is. What hope do we have to provide leadership for a continent?
Of course, and of course, whether we like it or not, South Africa is whether number one or number two, but certainly it's the most diversified economy on the continent, and it's the most capable from a financial infrastructure. So it's got the resources, it's got the global credibility, but it's not leading. And leadership, both in political sense as well as in corporate sense, is terribly lacking, and we're squandering national savings and national resources at a rate which is horrific. And here we can look at it, we've seen it in the public sector, we've seen it in the private sector. Hundreds of billions, rough estimates, about 600 billion has been wiped out by the private sector. And these are your global corporates. These are not SMEs or medium-sized businesses. These are the so-called global icons of South Africa, and then they're squandering these resources as much as the public sector is squandering. So the economy is crippled by these losses, and this is fundamentally an ethical issue, both in the public and private sector.
It is, and at the same time, we've got real fear and real desperation at play on our streets. I mean, we've got people who feel economically disenfranchised, that don't like the fact that there are foreigners who are coming to South Africa who seem to be doing better than them, who've started up businesses and operating businesses and are providing goods and services into an economy because they've made this their home and are making a go of it. And people, there's a huge amount of jealousy and disappointment at play here too.
I think that's quite frankly what I would call it first layer logic. That's a justification. It's not true. Many, many other economies, societies have got much more poverty, much more desperation, and the level of brutality and the level of anger and the expression of anger is nothing like what we have here. So I think we need to also temper that with a deeper logic and deeper ethical and moral reflection, and not just quickly justify it. And for a moment, I'm not disregarding that unemployment, poverty, and so on is a definite contributor. But the flip side of it is that if you have so much poverty, so much unemployment, and so on and so forth, what are you doing in the private and public sector, squandering hundreds of billions of rand all over the globe, venturing into all kinds of things, or siphoning from SOEs and and bringing the economy to its knees. That's where the cause is.
What's your assessment of the finance minister's plan, which you put on the table last week? I mean, a high level assessment, obviously, of the back to basics approach that he's recommending in terms of getting this economy moving.
Absolutely, it's nothing new, but it's a situation that even when somebody wants to do something, others, instead of rallying around to refine it and to make it better and more effective, they take out the knife and slash it into pieces as if nobody is allowed to do anything and as if we should allow the situation to wallow in its depression and its dilution of economic base. I'm absolutely surprised that nobody in various segments of the society, instead of rallying behind the minister and saying, look, here you got it wrong, let's refine it and so on, they're attacking him, which is quite bizarre.
Well, I love the opening line of the plan, which just said we are on an unsustainable path. We are in trouble. As an economy, we are in trouble. And that's undeniable. I mean, there may be better ways of fixing the economy than Tito Mboweni suggested, but then make those suggestions and let's get on with some implementation. I think that's the thrust of your message.
Absolutely. It's like saying that somebody is sick and everybody says, well, let's take him or her to the hospital. And everybody says, no. Let's do nothing. And yes, everybody says, unions say we are in trouble, politicians say we are in trouble, business is in trouble, and people experience trouble, and yet nobody wants to lead. Nobody wants to so-called stick the neck out and say this is a way so that we can refine it. And instead, the minute that somebody says something, the minute that somebody puts a package of turning the economy around, everybody is good into tearing it to pieces. This is an absolutely unethical, immoral conduct.
How do we, again, in 30 seconds, how do we begin to address it, Iraj? I mean, we're in desperate times and we need, hopefully not desperate measures, but certainly just some measures.
My suggestion, as I mentioned in my brief tweet, is the president has to change a step change. It has to lead. We have voted for him as a nation to lead, and there are so many ways of leading it, but he cannot just abdicate that responsibility and leave it to chance or leave it to a minister of finance who will be attacked by the right, left, and center. He's got to come in, form or constitute a war room, so to speak, Kodesa, if you prefer, Lekhotla, if you fancy, whatever the title, bring the leadership of various sectors around and say, guys, we have a joint problem. We've got to do something. It is not going to self-correct by itself. And time is not going to correct it. It's going to worsen it.
Raj Abedian, thank you. Heartfelt thoughts there. The Pan-African Investment and Research Chief Executive, Dr. Raj Abedian, taking no prisoners, as always. And he's absolutely right. I mean, our response to good ideas is disgraceful. Our response to the crises is inadequate. Our response to the burning platform that is South Africa is not going to fix the problems. We've got to have solutionist thinking. Isn't that what they call it? Solutionist thinking. We need another series of solutionist thinking to tackle these issues. After Eyewitness News at 7, we're going into our entertainment area. There are lots of people there. They're having some nice snacks and some drinks. And we're going to be talking this evening about youth unemployment and how we can solve the problem. Let's have a constructive hour-long discussion. Chief executives, we've also got the CEO of the Yes Campaign, who joins us in studio this evening as well to take us through some of the practicalities of what we can all do to have a positive impact. That's coming up in the next 7 minutes or so.